From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Justice Department puts Harvard in its crosshairs over affirmative action and allegations of racial discrimination in admissions.
If one group of students are held to higher standards based on their appearance, I mean, that's not right.
We'll dig in with our Week in Review panel, plus the wife of a Needham man who died of cancer finds a way to help his memory live on with the help of a complete stranger.
What am I going to do with this bike? You know, I didn't want to just give it away or sell it to someone. I wanted it to have meaning because it was so important to him.
Also today, Tom Brady faces questions about possible concussions.
I don't want to get into, you know, things that happened in my past, certainly medical history and so forth. I really don't think that's anybody's business, so.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman, TGIF, everyone. And since it is Friday, we'll jump right into our Week in Review.
If one group of students are held to higher standards based on their appearance, I mean, that's not right.
And that is Swan Lee speaking to NPR this week. Lee is an organizer from Brookline, Mass., who is part of a group asking the Department of Justice to investigate Harvard amid allegations the Ivy League school discriminates against Asian Americans. This week, the Justice Department said it does have Harvard in its crosshairs over affirmative action. Attorney Corey Liu, executive director of the group Students for Fair Admissions, told WBUR race is something you're born into and shouldn't be a factor in admissions.
Should the government be sorting us, determining the destiny or educational opportunity based on that is so arbitrary.
Natasha Warrico, who teaches and writes on diversity at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, cautions against an end to affirmative action.
We know what happens when you end affirmative action, where it becomes a very isolating experience for someone who is Black or Latino. It was designed as a mechanism, one small means by which we address racial inequality in American society.
And of course, we heard from Harvard in a statement. Harvard says the university complies with the legal standard as established by the Supreme Court, that is, of affirmative action, and for the first time ever in admissions. The majority of the incoming class at Harvard is non-white. Joining us now in the studio this Friday afternoon to talk about all of this and the rest of the week's news is Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hi, Michael. Nice to see you again.
Good to be here.
And with us this week is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about this. We have some major institutions, I mean, including the Department of Justice and Harvard, in the middle of this conversation. Have we been here before? And is it the place for the Trump administration to be jumping in? Michael?
Yeah, I mean, we've been here before. I remember back to the Clinton years when Christopher Edley was in the administration and working on affirmative action issues. And we had a private meeting here at Harvard to talk about the attacks on affirmative action and to really have a civil rights response to those legal cases that were going on across the country. I think we're here again, and elections have consequences. So what we're now going to see is we're going to see a Trump administration try to roll back many of those gains. And that's chess, not checkers, right? It's the Supreme Court that's heavily leaning towards against affirmative action. And it's the changes that are made in the agencies below the president, particularly in the Department of Justice. We're seeing that play out. And it is very disturbing.
Michael, I did want to ask you more about the it's very disturbing part, because you are with the NAACP. You have seen affirmative action work in a most positive way for minorities, for African Americans. This is about Asian Americans. This is about African Americans, too, though, and about any minority.
Well, it's
about white people.
It's artful, right? Because part of the conversation is around people of color that have been historically denied access to these institutions, Harvard being one of the many. And that the affirmative action for many generations has been for white folks to take advantage of those seats. And I always debunk the myth that they're all super talented white folks, that the reality is many of them got those slots because of relationships and legacy and donations and so forth. there are seats that are not just because you had great test scores. And that's almost any institution you can think of.
Tom Keene, I don't mean to put you on the spot like this, but you did go to Harvard, and you are a brilliant person and a white person at that. What though, do you make of this, of your alumni, of your school?
Well, I just have to say, I wish I had been a legacy, but unfortunately, it didn't come out of those circumstances. So, you know, if in fact the allegation is that because you are Asian American, there are people who are actually saying that the Harvard is saying you cannot go, that's very different. But and that, I think, really starts to raise some issues. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I think what's going on here is Harvard does not only look at grades. Harvard looks at the sort of the qualities that a person has. Have you been a leader in your school? Have you participated in a variety of activities that makes the institution think you might be someone who makes a mark on society? Are you creative? Do you have some original thoughts? Do you have perhaps an unusual ethical or moral standards? You know, a kid who had good grades, not great grades, but started a soup kitchen would be of real interest there. And I think that's really what's going on here with Harvard, that people are saying you're not admitting us because I have perfect SATs and perfect grades, but that's not enough. That's not what defines admission at Harvard.
And you know, there is this admission offices, right? And there's a lot of parents who are talking about this in addition to federal agencies and universities themselves, wondering why not my kid? But there are these admissions offices that look very closely at who these kids are. I imagine that there also is some possible quota counting in some way, but it matters who you are. You're saying,
yeah. I mean, look, if you found someone who had horrific personal circumstances growing up, deep poverty, abuse, or something like that, and yet rises to become, say, president of her class. Boy, that's someone I'd certainly like to have at Harvard, because if I were Harvard, I'd be thinking, this is a person that's going to make a mark on society.
Taking it away from Trump, I want to bring in another voice on this. It's Tomiko Brown Nagin. She is a constitutional law professor at Harvard, and she says that what is happening right now is not only in the context of Washington, but it's in the context of increased tensions on campuses.
On the one hand, you have racial minorities, immigrants who are concerned about certain dynamics on campus. On the other hand, you have conservatives who feel like their voices are being shut down in debates over things like affirmative action and immigration and sexual assault.
So it's on campus and it's in the Trump administration. What does it mean that the Trump administration has jumped in on this?
Well, I think it means ultimately, and I think as part of the disturbing part of about that is that Donald Trump, President Trump, is delivering to his base of support. These were the deliverables in his candidacy. And the reality is you have a groundswell of people, I'd say the majority of the nation, that have a raised consciousness about the history of race and racism in this country, white, black, and other, that are now more conscious, more thinking, wow, we didn't understand that police abuses were that rampant in communities of color, or the wealth gap, or health disparities. And with that growing consciousness, you're getting a backlash of people saying, wait a minute, this means less opportunity for us, less seats for us. That's that investing in your own demise argument, right, is that people don't want to give up power and access to let other people in. And it may be conscious or subconscious, but it's going to happen. It's a reality. There are more people who want access to those elite institutions and those positions and those elite law firms and medical schools. And it means less of the majority population that historically taken advantage of that to the detriment of other communities.
Tom, is it the place for the Justice Department to be putting resources toward looking at how college campuses are colored these days?
Well, it may not be the place, but it is what they're going to be doing. And I think if you talk about it as the deliverable, if you look at Donald Trump's base, his base is perhaps a rightfully aggrieved white blue collar white Americans who feel that they've been left behind in the economic mainstream. I think where the mistake has happened is to somehow say to that group, it's because of African Americans or Asian Americans that somehow we're pitting you off against each other. That's not the case. I mean, if one group has been left behind, by all means, try to help bring them forward. But you don't have to do that to the detriment of someone else.
Last question on this. I'm just wondering from either of you, are you surprised by any particular group's reaction to how this has played out this week? I mean, this has been ongoing for some time. But is anything surprising you from a particular culture, from a particular race or group that's organized in some way?
No, I think maybe the theme here that I think has to play out is the relationship between the African-American community and Asian community. I think we have not had the kind of conversation across races or across ethnicity around what this means. Because ultimately, as I said, chess, not checkers, ultimately, even if you're an Asian student, go to Harvard, do you have just as much access to lead that law firm or that medical school? And the data doesn't bear that out. They're graduating from the tops of their classes, but still running into those ceilings within the professions that they go into. So the reality is the work of the NAACP and other civil rights organizations ultimately is for them too. So we have to figure out a way to make sure that Asian students who are performing well and aren't disadvantaged, but that we still address the issue of other minorities and other communities of color that are being discriminated against.
I think that's a good point on Asian Americans. They're often called the quote-unquote model minority, and in a sense it means because we stereotype them and we typecast them.
Okay, let's shift gears for a moment and head over to the Registry of Motor Vehicles in Boston and Haymarket down there in Government Center, where four clerks were charged this week, Wednesday, in connection with an alleged scheme to give false identification documents to unauthorized immigrants in exchange for cash. The U.S. Attorney's Office says the four clerks and two other people obtained the information of real Social Security cards and birth certificates from real people, and they are in Puerto Rico, and they use them to issue licenses with the stolen identities. We have some tape here from Republican State Representative Shauna O'Connell from Taunton, who said to Fox 25 News.
Law enforcement estimates that there are tens of thousands of people out there right now with stolen identities that have a Massachusetts driver's license. We need to arrest these people on the spot when they walk into the RMV.
And according to a statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office, some of the false identities and addresses were used to fraudulently register to vote in the city of Boston. Mass. Secretary of State Bill Galvin doesn't say that's the case. He told WBUR this.
It does appear that of the, I believe, 30 names that they presented us with, the 10 had registered to vote using the fraudulent information that they purchased illegally, but none of them appear to have voted.
And he went on to tell Fox 25 more.
When people steal legitimate identities, and these were legitimate citizens who had IDs that were stolen from them, and the bribery on the part of the registry employees that's alleged allowed them to access these identities, there's not much anybody can do.
I have to confess that when I first heard the story come down, I felt like a flashback to some other time of a state agency run amok, but it's not the same time, like looking at state governments that are now connected to very much into federal databases. It's so much bigger. It's a digital world. Voter registration is connected to state registrations of different kinds, supposedly easier to get to vote. What do you make of this? Again, the Trump administration is coming to some very once upon a time places that they didn't have to enter, or federal government didn't enter.
Well, I think it's important just to back up that understand this is not new for the registry.
No, this corruption is not new for the registry.
We've been there under the past three administrations of the registry, and we've been trying to figure that out. On the federal side, I think the link between the voter fraud and integrity issues, and then trying to tie that to cases like this where such sporadic issues about voter identity theft really feeds into this notion that we need a voter integrity commission. That to me is a distraction from voter suppression, which is the real issue. And I think Galvin is to be commended and others across the country who are refusing to play into that narrative.
I just want to, Michael, build on what you said. In 2012, there was a clerk at the RMV who was accused of taking money from illegal immigrants, promising them to get driver's license and fix various immigration problems. Something again happened in 2013. There were 200 fake IDs allegedly were made to people who produced Puerto Rican identifications, again, in exchange for cash.
Right.
So it's not new. My flashback may have been to that. But that aside, Tom, it's city government.
My flashback was to underage government. Teenage kids who also get fake IDs.
But yes, my flashback exactly was to New York State, where it was paper when I was under 18.
Right. Not that I knew any of those people. Michael's right. Look, if this was about identity theft, this would not be a story. This is only a story because a handful of these people allegedly registered to vote, and it feeds now into this whole national conversation pushed by the Trump administration that there were millions and millions of fraudulent voters out there voting for Hillary Clinton. It's real easy to find out if these people voted, and that's what Galvin did. He went through the voter rolls and noted that none of them had been checked off as voting. The reason they registered to vote is to give them an additional layer of protection to prove that they're really citizens. This is not part of voter fraud, and I really think it's a nothing story.
There's a nothing story, maybe, but I'm pretty amazed. This is that these folks who are working at the registry had the nerve, the idiocy, the whatever it is, the naivete to think that in this day and age,
age when there is such a digital life, that this could just happen still.
Well, it's disturbing to me, I think, because I know that the registry under Rachel Caprillion and I believe under her administration put a lot of work into making sure this didn't happen.
Right. And I do need to say allegedly. I'm sorry. I really need to back up. And these folks are, you know, these folks are caught in something, whether or not they are truly guilty of it.
But, and there's all kind of controls put in place to make sure this didn't happen, and then audits that happen after the transactions. So I think they're going to have to go back to the drawing board at the registry and figure out how to make sure. I mean, ultimately, you can't eliminate the abuse within the system, but you can mitigate the risk of it happening. And I think they're going to have to revisit that.
You were in city politics, Tom, and at a different time, maybe, right, when things were not so connected inside of databases that not everybody could access. But how hard is it to get this kind of corruption stopped? How hard is it to really check on all this?
So it seems to me that the best way to stop this corruption is to require a two-person system, that you have one check on another. It's really hard. People in conspiracies are really tough to keep together. It's possible. But if you have two people with looking or having to pass over a claim, it becomes much more difficult to, say, have to bribe both of them in order to, you know, to start fixing the identities here.
Ready for another story of the week?
Okay. Absolutely.
This one is television related, and it is serious, though. Another story. It's been simmering since 2014. It's now boiling over into federal court in Boston.
Hello, chefs, and welcome to Boston, the historic host city of this season of Top Chef.
I'm the hometown girl. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm here to win this for Boston.
Of course, we're talking about Top Chef and the trial that got underway this week. I just want to know ahead of time, do either of you watch the show?
I do.
Okay.
I do not.
Okay,
I hesitated for a second. I do.
I'm glad you speak the truth. Okay.
It's really embarrassing, isn't it?
It is embarrassing.
You do, Tom. You watch it, don't you?
No, I don't.
All joking aside, this is an important case that is involving
diners,
unions,
drivers, and yeah.
That, oh, wait.
I watch that.
Okay. Maybe we should throw this whole thing out and talk about what you watch on TV. Teamsters involved, accused of threatening to disrupt the filming of a reality TV show in its 12th season, a well-known show, well loved by some, unless the production crew agreed to hire union labor. So producers of the TV show allege the Teamsters were blocking vehicles, slashing tires, threatening to use physical violence, yelling profanities, racial slurs. We talked about this yesterday on Radio Boston after the day in court was done. Here is a brief interaction that was released this week. I believe it was played in court yesterday. It's amazing to watch the visual of it. It's this is just the audio, of course. It came from the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's some of the Teamsters and a Top Chef producer.
Your mama would be so proud.
Yeah. At least she knows I'm not a scab like you.
What'd you say?
You heard me.
You're right.
Good.
Wow.
It's a pretty powerful video if you get a chance to watch it. Have you seen it, Michael or Tom?
I've not seen it.
The Teamsters say they are exercising their right to picket. There are racist slurs thrown in here. This could be a hate crime in some other view. Mayor Walsh, in some way, his administration has a connection to this. We'll talk more about that in a second. What is your take on this in terms of Boston being a union town, a non-union town, a town that has lured film and television shows here, is a plus? Michael Curry?
You know, I have a flashback right now to Mayor Menino when he was having the challenge with the firefighters, right? The imagery of folks who are labor and who are fighting for what's right and fair wages and whatever else was a part of that negotiation. But at the same time, the problem is when the passion crosses over into a meanfulness, a hatefulness, and then you start to get the crazy words and the racial hatred and all the other stuff that comes with it. I think, you know, I'm proud of the fact that we have such a strong union town that is Boston, but disturbed whenever this boils over into the kind of wheeling and dealing and threats and embezzlement and so forth that happens every so often. Unfortunately, it is a part of our history, though. It's the untold story, and I'd love to read a book one day on how much it happens and how many folks have been complicit with it.
You know, people want to get their work done, both the guys who drive and the gals who drive trucks and the people who are trying to make a TV show or a movie. They just want to do their job. But there are some systems that exist in the U.S., and they do fall out here in Boston in terms of who gets certain contracts. Tom, what have you seen in your history in the city of Boston as a city councilor, former city councilor, and watching how the city has built up or how things get done?
So I think that in particular, this incident talks about a long history we've had with TV and film production and how that has really been – for a while we were almost blacklisted by Hollywood because there was such rampant feather bedding that you come in to try to do a production. All of a sudden, you're required to hire people you don't really need because it's just the Hollywood producers are seen as piggy banks. We tried to really climb our way out of that. We've put in place very healthy state tax credits to try to encourage production within the borders of the state. This, I think, is really going to hurt a long-term objective on the part of the state and of Boston to make itself seem friendly to TV and film.
And just to add, it's a little bigger than that because we go back to even the transportation contract between Keolis and NBCR. We saw a similar version of that play out. So I think it goes across whether it's the film industry, whether it's transportation, healthcare, there's probably examples across the city.
So let's also talk about Mayor Marty Walsh in the middle of all this, which he happens to be a former union leader. That's, you know, so that's great. You know, that's fine. That's about labor and who he was. He does have a close relationship between the Teamsters. I believe he was a guest on Top Chef. Is that may be the issue at hand here? Is that was there anything that we understand that's alleged is true at all about trying to get the Teamsters work on this show because of Mayor Walsh? I believe this is alleged by it is alleged in somewhere in a court testimony that I'm going to try to find while we're talking about this. But Tom, what do you know about the mayor's involvement with Teamsters and any of this?
So I don't know anything.
Of course,
the allegation here is that a top city hall official actually was willing to hold permits and withdraw the permits if, in fact, there wasn't going to be some sort of union involvement here. That is the allegation that was made in the trial this week. That same official is separately under fire for having withheld permits for Boston Calling, the music festival as well. And whether the sort of political question here is Marty Walsh is up for re-election this year. And this is one of these things that if it moved upwards and actually threatened to engulf him or other senior staff could truly have a consequence.
Do you hear buzz about this, Michael Curry?
I do. And I've for years heard buzz about elected officials in general playing that game of holding submissions and contracts and construction bids and all of those things. So I think ultimately this is about being honest with ourselves as a city, that this is how business is done. This is how things are done, and we're trying to change that culture. So we need a commitment from our elected officials that they just will not continue that going forward. And that's tough because it's a political risk, as we know, even in this film industry piece, that if you were to come out against this piece, getting them positions, then it hurts you on the election side. In right. Carmen Ortiz's case, it worked out because she was appointed, not elected.
Interesting.
Right.
Let us turn one more page today. To a little humor, a little lightness at the end of some pretty heavy news all week long, as it is in life. Before we run out of time, please, I would love to hear what story tickled your fancy this week, Tom Keene. What may have given you a chuckle even?
Well, as the folks around here at this studio know all too well, reconstruction has begun this week on the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge. Governor Baker's transportation secretary urged folks to stay away, promising a quote-unquote hellish 3 weeks, while commentators spoke darkly of Carmageddon. Okay, can we get a grip here? It's one bridge. There are many alternative ways into the city aside from the Mass Pike. Route 9, Storrow Drive, Route 2. It is possible to get here, and at the worst, it's just a traffic jam.
Tom, I got lost this morning.
You can't get lost.
I've lived here for 20 years. I was coming from Cambridge, and I got lost.
Just use Waze.
I did.
I suspect the hyperventilating on part of the state officials was all about getting us to pay attention so we might, in fact, seek out these alternate routes. But too many of the scare-us-to-death routines, I think after a while we're going to stop paying attention at all.
All right. Michael Curry, how'd you come into here today? I just want to know before you tell us your hubbub.
I actually took the train because I had been warned that to not drive, and I usually drive.
Did you like the train?
Did
you have a shuttle bus or a train?
You know what's funny? It was the train to Kenmore and then the shuttle from Kenmore to here. So it wasn't bad. And I actually enjoyed it.
Good to know. What's your hubbub?
I think, you know, it's probably, you know, the shakeup in the State House. There's been a few stories about a lot of the changes in the Senate and in the House and new leadership and some folks who've gotten put into some key positions. I think that change is good. And I'm actually excited about some of the change, particularly Jeffrey Sanchez being the chair of House Ways and Means, a Latino. So I think that the stories around that has been encouraging for many of us who want to see more diversity throughout the statehouse.
Listen, this is not a humorous thing. This is a heartfelt.
So the humorous part of it. Well, it's probably no humorous part of it.
In politics, there's always something. All right, so mine is, it's probably as obvious as the coffee in your cup, perhaps, the donut on your plate. Dunkin' Donuts has announced that it is going to attempt a trial run, out in California at least, of dumping the donut from its signage, its marketing. So you're going to see Dunkin'. But they have, I mean, arguably they have had, you know, Dunkin' in there. But it's a donut shop. For God's sake.
I know. And not only that, but the whole Dunkin' part about putting your donut in your coffee is so disgusting
these days. Oh. I never understood it.
Wait, you don't dunk your cup?
Oh, God,
Wait. An old-fashioned, you know, with none of the gook on it?
No.
Okay,
no.
We'll get to it. Well, maybe we'll do a dunk a donut off. Tom Keene doesn't dunk his donut in coffee. He's a former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Curry took a tea and a bus to get here today. He is president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, former president, and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thank you so much for getting here.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. You are listening to Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.
I don't want to get into, you know, things that happened in my past, certainly medical history and so forth. I really don't think that's anybody's business, so.
That is Tom Brady speaking earlier today to reporters in Foxborough following practice. He was answering questions about football's link to the traumatic brain disease, CTE. Earlier in the year, supermodel Gisele Bündchen, his wife, made headlines when she said he regularly has concussions throughout the football season, and this is despite not having any concussions reported to the NFL as required.
He had a concussion last year. I mean, he has concussions pretty much. I mean, we don't talk about, but he does have concussions, and I don't really think it's a healthy thing for your body to go through like a, you know, through that kind of aggression like all the time, and that could not be healthy for you, right? I mean, I'm planning on having him be healthy and do a lot of fun things when we're like 100, I hope.
And we imagine there's a whole lot of conversation that happened in their house. So once she got home that day to talk about health and head injuries and what is public. So joining us now to talk about what is public, what is private and all of this, WBUR sports and society reporter and my competition in energy, Shira Springer, welcome back to the show. You're so welcome. It's great to have you in here. Does Tom Brady have a history of being secretive with his private information, information about who he is?
I mean, for a guy who is basically the face of the NFL, he is an incredibly private guy. You only sort of see and hear about Tom Brady what he wants you to see and hear. He's very conscious of controlling his image. He's very conscious of what he puts out there. I mean, occasionally you'll get that treat video like him jumping off a cliff or having fun with the missing jersey search after the Super Bowl, but he is very controlling about the personal information, the personal side of his life that gets out to the public. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget this concussion conversation. You're talking about personal medical history with Tom Brady. This is his personal medical history. He has no obligation to tell the public in a press conference. However, as you did mention, the NFL does have a concussion protocol policy, and that policy does require athletes to inform coaches, medical personnel, if they feel they've suffered a concussion, and teams have to inform the NFL.
Let's get to more on this. What is maybe a personal decision to keep something private and what other maybe athletes have done? But let's hear a little bit more from Tom Brady. He did offer some thoughts on this CTE research, brain trauma research that's been in the news recently.
It's great that there's more awareness for those types of things. That's been a very important topic, certainly. But you just try to be proactive to take care of your body as best way you can.
So again, that was today after practice. He made reference to his health routine and being proactive, Shira. But what is unique about how he trains, especially when it comes to brain health that you know of?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think everybody knows or has heard about the avocado ice cream and, you know, the sleep and no alcohol, no caffeine and limited tomatoes and other inflammatory foods. And his diet and his sort of sleep and exercise routine gets a lot of publicity, but he has also been doing some pretty aggressive brain training for about the last 3 years. He works with something called Brain HQ, I believe is the name of the computer program. And that's basically what it is. It's a set of something like 29 or 30 computer drills. And, you know, one that he does is something that works on his peripheral vision, but it's all geared to sort of conditioning your brain to think faster and to think better. And he swears by it. And he believes that that kind of brain conditioning, those kind of brain exercises are what gives him an edge on the field and also will keep his brain in sort of better functioning for longer.
So he's not the only one obsessing about his health, right? So we as the public who watch football, who watch Tom Brady and many others, watch what the fitness routines are. And especially since, as our producer Sean mentioned, he turned 40 yesterday. Tom, not Sean. He is still at the top of his game. It's remarkable. And this is what he had to say about, again, keeping it private, about what is happening in his life.
There's other people that do worry about that, my wife or my parents or my sisters or, you know, people that love me and care about me. But, you know, I do the best I can do to come out and be prepared to play and mentally and physically.
So let's get to the point, Shira, that we were talking about back a few minutes ago with producers about what is a public personality like Tom Brady expected to keep private? What do we expect of him as fans? And doesn't he get to do what he wants to do? Or does he?
I do think he does get to do what he wants to do in terms of saying, like, you know, this when it comes to his private medical history. I also think what was good about some of the comments he made after saying basically it's none of your business when it comes to whether I've had a concussion or not is he did talk about his concern, you know, saying like this is an important issue. We are all aware of the BU study where, as you mentioned, 110 out of 111 brains of former NFL players tested were diagnosed with CTE, this degenerative brain disease. And he did say there's a reason to be concerned. There's heightened awareness. And I think it's important, while he can keep his own personal history private, you know, except for the obligations he has to report it to the NFL, I think it is important, though, for him to take a stand to a degree and say, listen, we have a problem here in the NFL with concussions, with head trauma, with degenerative brain disease. I do.
And you want that.
And I want that. I would expect, you know, listen, you don't have to go into all the science. You don't have to, you know, give some sort of major thesis about it. But I do think he is the face of the NFL. He is the premier quarterback. And he's someone that people look up to as a role model. You need to kind of be a little bit out there and say, we're concerned, I'm concerned, I recognize this is a problem, and not dismiss it.
All right, more to talk about this, especially as the season is about to begin, and we want to hear from you at some point, how you think the Pats are going to do, in your particular opinion. Thank you so
much. Odds on favorites to go to the Super Bowl again.
Oh, really? Oh,
I was going to say repeat as champion, so I probably should have just
Springer
gone with my original.
WBUR sports reporter, sports and society reporter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.
Well, you know that if
every child,
oh Lord,
every child of God,
they're running for Jesus,
just like an automobile.
Oh, that is so beautiful. That is Randy Green and the Silver Leaf Gospel Singers performing on WERS a few years ago. Green founded the group in 1945, and today it's one of the oldest gospel groups in the country. And very sadly, he passed away last week at the very beautiful age of 95. The Artery's Amelia Mason explores his life and legacy.
This is his Silver Leaf Lifetime of Achievement. I was there when they gave him that.
Melvin Francisco sits at a table strewn with papers. These are the accomplishments of Deacon Randy Green, or the Deacon, as he was known to Francisco and the other members of the Silver Leaf Gospel Singers. Francisco turns over a glossy photograph of the group, decked out in sharp red jackets and shiny crimson shoes. He picks up a 2004 article from Spirit of Change magazine.
It says Randy Green turns 83 on November 13, 2004. But to watch him on stage with the Silver Leaf Gospel Singers full of vitality and charm, he is truly an ageless human being.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
You tell Martha not to mourn.
Tell Martha not to mourn.
Listen to me, Mary, now.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell Martha
When Green passed away on July 27th, the Silverleaf Gospel Singers had been around for 72 years. Under Green's leadership, Silverleaf thrived, weathering countless lineup changes and appearing all over Boston and New England, from nursing homes and churches to concert stages and radio studios. They appeared at Club Passim and Sanders Theater, Symphony Hall, and the Newport Jazz Festival, and once even opened up for the Blind Boys of Alabama. At the center of it all was Green, a diminutive fellow with an impish stage presence.
He was the life of the party. Oh, are you pretty ladies in here? Y'all sure looking good. And then sometime he'd get out and do a little fancy step, you know. He did anything to get a response from the audience.
Which isn't to say Green wasn't serious about music.
He wanted it right, and in rehearsal he got it right. He was professional.
Jeffrey Thornton is the Silverleaf Gospel Singers' current director. He joined the group 9 years ago.
When I started, they were pretty hardcore. If we were in concert and like if I hit a bad note or something like that, they give you a little jab in the side. And you get it right.
Listen to me, Mary, now.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Tell Martha not to moan.
This music, especially in bad times, you can draw from it. And it somehow it makes you stronger. And I think that's why he was so passionate about his music. He lived it. He breathed it. It was just in his spirit.
My name is Randy Green. And I've been around quite a few years.
I visited Green back in June. He was living in a long-term care facility in Jamaica Plain, a world away from where he grew up in Tuskegee, Alabama, one of six children.
I was born in the country. I was raised in the country. Alabama was segregated. We were sharecroppers. In a sense, we had to work in the field.
Green dropped out of school after third grade and helped his family on the farm. Then he joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, a Depression-era work program that employed rural youth. That was followed by a stint in the still-segregated military. In 1943, Green followed his brother to Boston, part of the Great Migration of African Americans from southern states to cities in the north.
I came here in the wintertime. It was 18 below zero. Oh, my. I still have icicles in my nose. I don't know how I stood it, but I declare I wasn't going back south.
Green settled in Roxbury with his wife, Melba. They were married 75 years and had 11 kids. The church was a big part of their lives, along with the Silverleaf Gospel Singers. Green founded the group shortly after moving to Boston, part of an old tradition of all-male a cappella gospel music. Even though Silverleaf never achieved commercial fame, it became an institution in Boston.
We were just tickle pink, you know, that people were interested enough to give us a chance to try to see how good or how bad we, bad we were, you know.
Lord,
I'm on the right road now.
I'm on the right road now. I said, Lord, I'm on.
His first time the group got together to sing at Concord Baptist Church, they sounded so bad they had to walk around the block and come back and start it again. They still sounded bad.
Melvin Francisco, the Silverleaf singer from earlier, says Green was never deterred, and that attitude defined him. No obstacle was too daunting, as long as you tackled it together. That philosophy was enshrined in the Silverleaf motto.
Coming together means beginning, working together means progress, and as long as you're keeping together, you'll end up with success.
It's been 72 years, and the man who wrote those words is gone. But the Silverleaf Gospel Singers are still singing. It's what the deacon taught them to do.
That's the artery's Amelia Mason. Stay with us. There's more ahead coming up. A widow finds a way to help her husband's memory live on with the help of a complete stranger and a bicycle. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. More than 6,000 cyclists are gearing up for the Pan Mass Challenge this weekend. It's to raise money for cancer research, and riders will leave from Sturbridge, Massachusetts tomorrow morning and make their way to Provincetown by Sunday. It's 192 miles, and the fundraising goal this year is $48 million. Many riders know someone with cancer and are riding for them. Some riders are living with cancer or cancer in remission, and some riders are doing the PMC in honor of people they've never met. And among them is Chris Vargas of Mattapan. The man he rides for is Stuart Grief, who died of lung cancer almost a year ago. Amy Grief, his wife, and Chris Vargas are in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's good, and it's really good to meet you both. Amy Grief, please, would you tell us about Stuart Grief? Tell us about your husband, and what was he like?
Stuart was an intelligent, loving husband who was an avid biker, rode all the time. He got enjoyment from riding. He was healthy and vibrant, father of two daughters. We were married almost 31 years. In 2014, we were hiking on vacation, and he started to feel ill. That was in May. Was diagnosed in August of 2014 with stage 4 lung cancer out of the blue, a non-smoker. So everyone out there who thinks that only smokers get lung cancer, very wrong. He had a genetic mutation. It was called ROS1 mutation, which is only 1% of people diagnosed with lung cancer have that particular mutation. They started him on a targeted therapy. In 3 months, there was no evidence of disease. He was feeling great. So January of 2015, he decided he wanted to give back to the cancer community and to Dana-Farber. So he decided he was going to ride in the Pan Mass that summer. But unfortunately, by June, his cancer had come back. And in August, he was too ill to ride. It had metastasized to the brain. He underwent 10 days of full brain radiation, started a new targeted trial therapy in October of that year, did really well again. 2016 January, he rode in the Revolution, which was an indoor Pan Mass challenge event, and was really eager to do the Pan Mass again that August. Unfortunately, by the end of February that year, he was not feeling well again, had surgery in March, chemotherapy, but by the end of June, it was back, and on August 20th last year, he passed away from the disease.
So you're coming up on your first anniversary of a huge loss, a huge hole in your heart, and I thank you for explaining the evolution of this, because it's something you both lived with and your family lived with every day for those years of uncertainty. He wanted, as you said, to ride in the Pan Mass Challenge, and he's not. But Chris Vargas is riding in the name of your husband. And Chris, are you also wearing the gear of Stuart?
I'm wearing his helmet, gloves, and shoes that they gave to me.
How did you hear about Stuart Grief? How did you even hear about the Pan Mass Challenge? This is not something you've done before.
No, it's my first time doing the Pan Mass Challenge. So the founder of the Pan Mass Challenge came to my school, and he gave a presentation on the PMC. And immediately I was super impressed. Just the fact that everybody from all around the world just gathers together and rides for a common cause. And so already I was just like, I would love to be a part of something like that one day. Around February, I checked my email. PMC has sent an email to Europe. They were looking for someone to ride in Stuart Grief's memory. And it was one of those moments when a little voice came in my head and was just like, do it. Like, I read it, and I don't know why. I didn't grow up with my father, so maybe that's why I felt like so attached to the email. The email stated how they were looking for someone that was around 5'6", 5'7", I'm 5'4", maybe and a half.
And stand tall, man.
So I mentioned that on the email, how I'm like, I'm not 5'6", 5'7", but I'm 5'4", and I got a really big heart. So they chose me to ride in his memory. And
May I prompt you also to tell us about your mom, your mother, who had said something to you some time back about doing things for others, I believe.
I got my kindness from my mother. She believes in just doing good for others and not expecting anything in return. It's more like giving a helping hand when it's needed. And it kind of sucks because, like, nowadays, it, like, that's not even, like, the norm anymore. Like, you see someone in the street that needs help with, like, groceries or just, like, something small like that, and people don't even jump no more to even, like, help someone out. My mom put that in me since a young kid, and so whenever I had an opportunity to give an helping hand, I did it without even thinking about it. It was like a natural instinct.
Can you tell me about Amy and Chris, the first time you met, and how often you're in touch now?
We first met February, mm-hmm. probably around there. I had, obviously, after Stuart passed, a lot of things to deal with and his belongings, and I saw his bike, and I was like, what am I going to do with this bike? You know, I didn't want to just give it away or sell it to someone. I wanted it to have meaning because it was so important to him. So I was thinking, if there was someone out there who wanted to ride in the Pan Mass for him, who needed a bike at the same time, you know, and wanted to fulfill something for themselves as well, it was kind of like a perfect mesh. You know, I didn't have a rider. Chris didn't have the bike.
And Stuart must have been about 5'6", 5'7". Is that the idea? Is that the height requirement?
He would say he was 5'9", but I'm going to say that was stretching it a little.
Amy, will you be in Provincetown at the finish line?
Chris is actually going to finish at Gillette.
Gillette Stadium in Foxborough.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes, and I'm planning to be there.
So how many miles will you be riding, Chris?
27.
27. That is amazing. That is amazing. I don't want to be pat about this, but this is a life-changing event for you that came out of a life-changing event for you. And there is no silver lining to losing your mate. But you're both doing something rather remarkable. I thank you. Chris, what happens after the ride for you? Where do you take this kind of experience?
Where I grew up, my neighborhood was really rough, so, like, I just really want to make a difference. I want to be able, like, to pave the way for other people who want to do things like this but don't have the courage or feel like they're out of place for giving out a helping hand. Because, like I mentioned before, it's, like, not a lot of this happens around, especially my neighborhood. People don't really help out others, and I want to, like, break that chain.
You're like a seed. It's a good thing. And Amy, what do you want people to take away from what Chris is doing in the name of your husband?
That how two people from two different worlds, two strangers come together and can help each other out and share a common bond. I feel like it came from a totally different world than Chris, a privileged life. I want people to remember there are other people out there. People who need things that aren't privileged, that they're good people. They just haven't, you know, been lucky enough to fall into, you know, just by luck I ended up where I was in my family and my place in life. So nothing I did, just luck, you know. So I want them to realize there's other people out there who need people, you know, helping people with this illness and with cancer and helping these doctors find a cure for somebody, because even though they may not be affected by cancer, they certainly know someone who is, or they will. So hopefully this ride will instill that in people.
Well, Amy Grief, thank you so much for coming in. And Chris Vargas, good luck to you starting tomorrow. It's a great thing that you're both connected, and we really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you
so much.
Amy Grief's husband, Stewart, passed away from lung cancer in August of 2016, and Chris Vargas of Mattapan will be riding 27 miles in Stewart's memory as part of a team from the organization Year Up, which helps provide education and guidance to low-income students. Just a bit more about Chris. He just graduated from Year Up this week, and Amy was there, and he starts a part-time job as a media technician at Harvard in the fall, and he'll be going to school part-time. Chris also hopes to ride the full Pan-Mass Challenge at some point, he told us just as he was leaving the studio. You can find links, that is, to Chris's fundraising page on our website, radioboston.org. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Alison Bruzek, Sean Bowden, Caitlin O'Keefe, and engineer Renee Marchandeau. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. We hope you have a great weekend. I'm Jill Kaufman, and this is Radio Boston.